also head of business and enterprise, Bizarre. That's a whole other story over a pint. At a university in Lincoln called Bishop Berstess University. So that's where I work. I live in Fife. Maybe work that one out. So I'm up here today because a big chunk of my work, particularly I would say in the last 10 years, or actually longer, 15 years, has been around the use of a particular methodology called the six-part story method, which is what we're going to have a crack at today. And I say have a crack at because you're going to do it rather than me talk to you about it a lot. So during the doing, any questions, you just ask. Okay, there's no standing to attention for that. My history is a bit weird, but for the past sort of, I would say, 20, 25 years, I have been involved quite substantially in social, political, and educational theatre. I have a background particularly in the work of Augusta Boal and the Theatre of the Oppressed. That's influenced a great deal of what I've done. But very recently, I got really excited about the potential for the six-part story method to be used in a way that would enable this idea of embodied reflexivity, whether it's young person embodied reflexivity or adult embodied reflexivity. So the way I thought it was easiest to do today is if I pitch it for you, if I do it with you, then as you're asking, you can be thinking about, well, you know, what are the implications? But this methodology can be used in lots of different ways. I'm going to give you a tiny bit of background. The six-part story method was invented, I suppose, by a drama therapist called Muli Lachad and his colleague, Afra Aylon, back in 1992-ish. I mean, I don't think they woke up one morning and invented it. You know, it was kind of something that occurred. So I've written down their names and just the dates so that that's easier. They still work as drama therapists in Israel, working with children who have been traumatized by the conflict out there. And they work with Palestinian and Israeli youth. And what they wanted to do was look at the idea of creating a diagnostic tool for drama therapists to use to enable them to understand the way in which children cope with the trauma of conflict. Okay, so what they did, because storytelling and story methodology is a big thing in therapeutic work anyway, particularly within the field of drama therapy and play therapy. So what they did was they used the idea of the storytelling process to try and work out, well, what is it about the way in which children attack a story or approach a story that would tell me how they cope in life? And actually, you can translate that to, doesn't, you know, to any age. It's not really just about children. So they developed this thing called the six-part story. And this is also based on the idea that every story people tell have certain characteristics in them. Okay, so there's certain things that always exist in a story. So give me one thing that you think always exists in a story. Every story you've ever heard.
Character.
A character. There's always a character, isn't there? There has to be, otherwise what's the story about? So even if the character's a stone, that's still the character, yeah? So there's a character. What else?
Beginning.
Yeah, so there's sometimes a structure, isn't there? There's a beginning, middle, end. Although there is some research now about the fact that stories aren't linear. So when you tell a story, especially if you're emotionally, it tends to go all over the shop, and you start at the end and then go to the middle and back to the end and then go to the beginning and da da da. But yeah, there is that kind of thing. What else exists in a story?
Location.
Yeah, location, the setting, the space in which it happens. Yeah, okay.
Imagination.
Yep, you definitely need imagination after a fashion. And sometimes that imagination comes from your own, well, often your own real experience. So what the child is telling you through the story is actually them, but it's one step removed, and we're going to talk about that aesthetic distance in a minute. What else? So we've got character, we've got the space in which the story happens, and on the sideline we've got the structure, and we've got the creativity and imagination. Yeah, plot lines, themes, something that happens, that a path that runs through, which can often be related, not always, to the task that the character has to do. It's something around, you know, for example, the seven basic plot lines, you've got quest, you've got return and, you know, voyage and return. You've got all these kind of things. Rags to riches. Those are the kind of basic plot lines that we have. What else might be there? Time is an important thing. Not always, though. Space. temporal space as well as geographical space can sometimes be important. And of course you've got the aesthetic space as well, that triangle. You often get, with a story, you often get characters within the story that oppose or support, or things within the story that stop or enhance. Yeah, so you get that as well. And then, of course, like you were saying, the structure, at the end of the story, you have the end. And that doesn't necessarily mean it is the end. It just means that's where this particular thing that we're doing finishes. So these things are common in every story. And if you use that kind of process to enable a child to tell the story, then actually what you get is something very interesting in terms of unpacking how they process story as a way of working. Now, just to give us a little chance to think about that a bit, I've given you a card. You can have a look at your card if you want to have a look. So we're going to tell a story in a round. And what we're going to do is, using the card that you have, you're basically going to follow on the story from someone else. Okay, so someone's going to start, don't they? Up to you. And the story will evolve using the card you have. So you're not, you can be very literal and say, for example, you have what looks like a prison cell almost. So I have a cell, you know, there is a person in a cell. But also, what could that symbolise? So what could that mean? So sometimes if we think of cells, we think of perhaps restriction, constrained, I am confined or whatever. Okay, so you can be literal or symbolic, doesn't matter. So someone's going to start, we're going to go right the way around the room, see what happens, and then finish the story off, and just see if some of these things that we're talking about actually emerge out of the telling process. Okay? So who'd like to kick off? Me, I can hear you. I know it's internal, but I can hear you.
I'll start.
Wait. Now, Beth, which way would you like to go?
That's
true. Not on your own. I think the last few. Yeah.
No, because I was just going to ask you a question. Uh-huh. Does your little bit of story, does it need to hold on to there, or is it just
as much as humanly possible? Although, if you do this in a pub after hours, wherever you go. So, on you go there.
Okay.
Do you want to show us your card as well?
You can see it's a ring. Mm-hmm. Ring. So I'm thinking this probably more symbolically. It's about belonging,
okay,
or relationships.
Okay.
So what would I say? That I'm someone who has got a very close relationship with someone. In my life.
Absolutely. And what I'm hearing is that you're taking it as you, so Beth has.
Yes.
What we could do is we could take it one step out of you,
okay, right,
so that we could make that aesthetic distance I was talking about, the degree of distance. So instead of being
call that character.
Yeah, you say, once upon a time there was a lady called somebody,
right? Call them Lucy.
Once upon a time there was a lady called Lucy,
and she had a very close relationship with someone in her life. Is that
perfect?
Okay?
Yes, that's wonderful.
This person was her dad, who had lost his wife some years previous, and likes to sit on the beach near his house reflecting on his lost love.
Oh, wow.
How long have you been
It's already got a really interesting thing happening here, because do you see that if we had made a personal story?
Yeah.
Do you see how suddenly actually you've taken my story and you're not telling my story? What are you doing? But actually, once you separate that out, you get that degree of distance. The story somehow becomes separate from you, and yet you're still connected. And that's the big, you know, depending on how connected you get, that's where the embodied bit comes in. So, okay. Sorry, Bridget.
It's all right. Okay, carry on.
No, over to you.
This is a two-headed person. Okay, so Lucy's dad is actually, while thinking about his lost love and good relationship they had, is worried about Lucy because the person that Lucy's in love with has got two sides to him.
Ooh.
There's one bit that's nice, caring, sees her as an equal. There's another bit that is really quite controlling and cold. And these bits can alternate, sometimes over long periods, you know, there can be long periods of one bit and then short periods of the others, or they can flip-flop quite quickly.
You're listening to the Archers.
This is for another time.
Okay. Yeah, we get that a lot quite
rarely. What, my mind is worryingly blank. Yeah.
Do you want to show us what you've got?
So I've got this kind of a shadow. The thing that keeps coming in my mind is a kind of a weight of sort of dark emotion. So who was that again?
This is the person that Lucy is close to.
Yeah.
The one that her dad's worried about.
Okay. So that person has a darkness, as has already been said, but there's a real weight to it based on something that's happened to them in the past.
This is great, isn't it?
Okay. Which leads on nicely, because this is his mother and the boyfriend's mother, and she's just not a very warm, loving mother at all. She's very dark. And she has to take some responsibility for her son's split personality.
Okay.
But meanwhile,
Lucy, you get that as well. Meanwhile,
Lucy is definitely looking at the rainbow and looking for the light, and she doesn't see these two sides to this individual. She sees a very happy and bright future, and that walking into the sunset together.
Okay.
What seems to be missing is the grounding for this family, their home. And what Lucy is thinking of is a gingerbread cottage, because food and comfort are kind of what she is seeking. And this is one way of finding that happiness.
And that's because she knows from her parents' life that her dad had sort of a shaded sort of dual personality, and there were things that happened for her, and she can see the positive in Robert, Lucy's boyfriend, and also she can see the side that's a bit prickly when he feels vulnerable. But then,
thank you. But then, what Lucy realised was that she had the opportunity to go on an amazing journey in this whole situation. She had the chance to learn about herself, but she also had the chance to learn about this man that she had fallen in love with, and perhaps even look at changing the way in which he...
She has secrets. This is an image of a prison cell. The secrets are locked inside her. And she feels she's a prisoner to her secrets. But there's also some hope about maybe finding a way to share her secret. One secret in particular.
And with this lover, this loved one, although she sees only the good in him, what she doesn't see is that she is a prized possession to him. And doesn't see the controlling side of his nature.
That we have a script. Shall we sell it?
Sure.
So exciting.
Well, I think the secret, in part the secret in her past, is that she's got unresolved issues with the relationship with her mother. And as much as there were some really good aspects, there were some things that override that. So because by not coming to terms with some of that relationship, in the back of her mind, she's beginning to view her mother in this light, which may have issues for the future. And then I can see white in your eyes. And then
Lucy remembers some of the stories that her dad told her when she was a little child, and she remembers that actually what she's looking for, or that in life she can, all she needs to do to find what she's looking for is to kiss enough frogs, and then he may appear, or not.
I'm going to add an extra character to the story.
Oh, I love it.
This is Lucy's uncle. And he's a person of authority, so he's the king in the story. And he has control, some sort of control over the whole family. He's not very happy at all with Lucy's travel ideas. And he has an opinion about everything.
I don't know where to go with this. Can I try a blank?
You can start a new thread. You can do the meanwhile.
Okay.
Back at the camp.
What was
the thing? There
you go. Okay, I have this menacing looking woman. I'm thinking maybe Lucy isn't quite as blind to her boyfriend's duality as she seems, as people think. And she feels that inside her there's also a bit of a menacing aspect to her character.
Okay.
I have a waterfall. And I think I'd like to move the story on from just description, so I'm going to say she decides she's going to make that journey. She's going to take a leap and she's going to do it herself. She gets out the map, she buys the tickets, and she heads off.
And on that journey, she sees a Spaz, and the Spaz reminds her of a vase that her mum had when she was a young girl, where her mum kept all her trinkets. But Lucy remembers they came that vase and her dad being very, very upset. So she was buying this vase to replace for her dad.
And while she's on her travels, she's reflecting on her life, and she realises that whilst the first half of it is painted and happened, the second, the future, is a blank canvas.
Ooh.
And then, just like an axe, it comes to her in a flash.
Just forget the lot of flower here and sunshine. She would go out through the most amazing scenery and a wonderful desert, and she would go for a long walk, forget about it, they could sort themselves out, and she would just, and she came across the most beautiful flower, and the sun was shining. And
so in a way, at the end of our story, the moral of the story is Lucy didn't deal with her secrets that she had deep inside. She didn't see her boyfriend for who she was, and she escaped by going on her travels. So there are none so blind as
okay, so what's her element's character? Elements of task that the character had to undertake, which changed quite a bit. Helpful forces in there, things that maybe spurred her on. Hindering forces, things that tried to prevent her or were barriers. The action itself, where did it take place? What was going on? How did it come together? And then some form of ending. So there's still a bit of journey to go, but, you know, where is she when she's there? So this is the process of the six-part story, okay? And as a diagnostic tool, when people tell a six-part story, as they are going through the process of unpacking it for themselves, they write it down. So the original way this worked was that you had a sheet of paper folded into six parts, yeah? And you were asked by the therapist, think of the character in your story. Who's the character in your story? Draw your character in your story in the first box. Yeah. Then think about the task that the character has to undertake. Draw that in the second box, and so on. So that actually, what you get is this almost storyboard progression of this six part story coming together. The drama therapist's role then is to look at that context, look at that diagnostic tool, and work out from the way in which the person has talked about their coping strategies in the story. How do they best approach this? What is it that they do when they are in times of trouble or times of need? And that particular process is called basic PH, So you've got here, you're going to try and stick these up on the wall here, if that's okay. You've got a six-part story which you're going to have to hang on to because you're going to do one in a minute. Oops, you've got a six-part story here. And you've got this thing called basic pH. And what the basic pH stands for are the different possible ways in which someone will cope with a situation of stress that they are under, or a situation of trauma. So the B in basic stands for belief. Quite often, if people have a very strong religious or other belief value base, you'll find that in their story. So when they try and solve the issue in the story, it has a strong issue of, oh, well, we will pray to God, or we will, you know, the character does these things, or churches feature, so that's the belief element. The affective bit is the heart and the connection with wanting to engage the side of creativity almost to some extent. So you'll find a lot of processes around visual solutions, things like that. Social is them being able to connect with others. So in their solution to their story, there'll be lots of, I met this person and we helped and da-da-da. Imagination, very creative. So in terms of the story itself, it becomes incredibly fantastical. Is that even a word?
Mythical.
You know what I mean? It's just cognitive. Lots of, well, the character then worked out that if they had just dimmed the light. Smoking in the background. Cognitive is the bit about if you thinking things through. So the character worked out that all they needed was to do X and Y, and then if they did X and Y, then Z would happen. So very processing. And physical. So if stories involve a lot of running, jumping, grabbing, chasing, then these things are indicative of the ways in which someone might find that they cope with their trauma. Okay? Now, just because there's a lot of belief or a lot of social, doesn't mean that's it. Yeah? So oftentimes people have a mixture. So you'll see a mixture, but sometimes there's one that stands out quite a lot. The therapist can then decide, having seen this and talked with the person who's written the story about it, look, here are some other things that, you know, do you want to work on these things a little bit more, and let's look at what needs to happen. So that was the original idea of the six-part story. Okay, so the story comes in these six parts. After the telling of the story, it was then worked through with this diagnostic matrix. Now, I'm not a drama therapist, and I've never claimed to be a drama therapist, so I do not use it for drama therapy purposes. And if anyone did who was not a drama therapist, that would be a very, very, very bad thing to do. So here, nobody is doing therapy. Okay, let's just be very clear. But I do believe that there is a therapeutic therapy continuum on which anyone who works within a caring sector particularly sits. There just is, whether you like it or not. Down at the lower end of therapeutic work could be the sort of interactions that, for example, teachers have with children when they're just saying, how are you feeling? You're not feeling too good. So what's that about? What would make you feel better? You know, sort of affecting some form of change with the individual, but not, you're not doing therapy. And then up at this end, you have, I'm contracting with you for therapeutic, you know, for a therapy session. So what I'm arguing is that working with this methodology, it is possible to be at this lower end to enable young people, anyone, to understand what they're doing and why they're doing it, and then to look at ways of potentially affecting change in their behaviour to enable them to function more effectively. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
You can also use this method, and this is something I think we forget about a lot when we're talking about children who have been through really awful situations. I get that, but as a former teacher, in a class of children, I had several who were like that. I also had what I call the ghost children. The children you forget are there because they're fine, apparently. You know? They're just the ones that carry on, get on with it, do that. They don't have any difficult, particularly situations at home, da da da. But what about their nurturing in terms of their pushing and creativity? They're not high flyers. They don't, you know, they're the shadow children that sort of disappear to some extent. And I don't mean that in a bad way. It's just this process can be lovely for them too, to engage them in that creative thinking, to get them out of themselves and put themselves somewhere else. Right? So how does the six-part story method work? Well, you've told the story, but you haven't done the six-part story. So what I'd like you to do, if I told it for Steve, is your one, your two, your three, your four, your five. Your one, your two, your three, your four, your five. Your one, your two, your three, your four, your five. Your one, your two, your three, your four, your five, your one. Did I start with you? No, start with you. Right. So what we're going to do is all the ones are going to get together, the twos and so on. Okay? And what I'm going to do is if you could pass your cards back around this way to divvy it. I'm going to dish each group out six cards. Alright? And what I'd like you to do is, as a group, I'd like you to just sit together and look at the cards. Okay? Have a think about the cards. And then I'd like you to create a story as a group. Okay? Using the cards. So you're going to look at this, look at what you've got. Try and create a story. You don't need to base it on anything particular, but I would like you to think about it as this kind of one step removed. So it's not your story, it's the story of the group. Okay? Now, in order to form that story, it is very possible that you might be thinking in your own head about your own experiences and so on. What I'd ask you to do is, can you stay away from anything that's deep, dark, and, you know, that you don't talk about at parties? Because that costs more. All right? So don't do that. But you might want to think about, for example, some challenges or little things that have happened in your professional life that have caused you a bit of frustration. Not annoyance, anger, but frustration. And so if you're looking at a story around that, or joy or something, yeah, so whatever experiences you bring to the table, make sure that you're comfortable with those experiences. But the story you're creating as a group is the story of the group. Okay? So you're going to use these cards, create the story. And then what we're going to do is we're just going to listen to how the story plays back and maybe look at a couple of elements of the story. And we won't be able to do everyone's because we don't have time. But look at it through the use of something like image theatre. Now, before you have a canary, don't panic about it. Image theatre is actually basically about life. It's not dancing around the drama. It's part of the drama process, but it's more about, well, how would you think, or how would you stand if you were thinking or feeling in this way? Whereabouts in the room is this character? Is the character over here? Is the character over here? It's not acting as such, okay? But it's a way of visualising the story that's been created. The important thing probably to say as well is when I'm doing this with anyone, so when I've done it in my research work, the stories people told were their own, their stories belong to them, but they were fantastical, so therefore you couldn't understand the real story underneath. And nobody told the real story underneath. That was never part of the process. You were never asked, had nothing to do. So even when people are giving feedback and commentary about the story, it's about the story, it's not about you. Does that make sense? Okay. So, right, so in all the ones, do you want to huddle in a corner somewhere? All the twos, do you want to huddle over here? All the threes over here? All the fours over here? And the fives in the middle?
Hang on.
We'll make it quick, just because I'm thinking of time. What's 5 minutes? Maybe 10? Two, three? Let's see how long a piece of string is. Okay. So, who will be the keeper of the cards? Paula, do you want to be the keeper of the cards? That's your character. The cards. That's the horse. Hindering force, action, ending, in that order.
Six cards.
The story that the
okay, so I've been quite prescriptive as well. So I've said if I was giving you that as your character card, that is your character card. Okay, if I've given you the bowl of cornflakes as your task,
that's your task.
Alright. So, on you go. You've got about 5, 10 minutes. Come up with a story. Share the thoughts. As long as you know it, so that when you tell it back, you're comfortable. It's up to you.
I can see it.
Okay. Can I ask So, the situation is that due to time, unfortunately, I do need to move us on. So you've got an understanding of this process of creating this story. You can do this as we've done it as a group, but you can also get incredibly rich understanding of self and others through the process of doing this individually. So if you imagine you had those six cards yourself, and you were looking at it in terms of telling some aspect of your life, but through this one step removed. Yeah? And then in the process of the telling of the story to everyone else, and remember the story is fictional, so nobody knows your story except you, what then happens is that the participants are invited to give commentary but ask questions. You know, what are you seeing and what do you think you see? There's a difference between objective and subjective. So what I have actually heard is this, but what I think it means is this. And those two are quite important to differentiate, I think. So what we're going to do, because you've done it as a group, is each group's going to tell their story, and then what we're going to do is just look at unpacking one a tiny bit, and I say a tiny bit because we really don't have terribly long, but I'll do one of the techniques that I've done so that you can see the visual element of what we're talking about. So which group would like to tell their story? And honestly, don't worry if it's all a bit upside down. As you're telling the story, it'd be really helpful to show people the cards that you think relate. And if it doesn't, if you haven't told it in that kind of linear fashion, that's okay. You can put them out.
Oh no, we've done exactly.
I'm not surprised. Okay, go on.
It's show and tell. So this is an angel. We can't see the angel's eyes. So the angel's lost the window to its soul. They need to get their eyes back. I'm back from this thing from hell. A helpful force is nature. They need to tap into the creative forces of nature, of the earth, and the tree is the life force of the universe. But earth isn't all good. The angel helps the good tree, helps the angel to find frogs. Frogs need, she needs the key, it needs the cleansing actions of the frog's tears, and finds the frog, and lo and behold, the frog helps the angel to see the flame.
Now, just even in the listening, was there anything standing out to you? What was the most important thing to you as the listener hearing that story? It doesn't matter whether it was the most important thing for them. What was the most important thing that stuck with you as a listener?
Tapping into nature.
The quest itself.
An angel who was blind.
Okay, so already what's happening is you're going, that's resonating with me somewhere. And then through the discussion would be, what was that about? Where did that come from? Not, I don't want you to tell me, but I'm telling you that this is my reaction to it. So, interesting. Okay. Next group.
God. Our character is a man who he's in a dark place. He's wondering whether to be a conscientious objector or in a conflict situation.
But one of the things he does have, his helpful forces, is a really good problem solver, so he's able to work his way through that problem in his head.
Sometimes he feels like a bit of a dark dog and is on edge.
But he makes the decision to stand strong and to grow as a conscientious objector.
And that's his journey.
Ooh.
Yeah. It's not a competition.
Same question though. What's up with you?
That enduring symbol of that flag.
Feather. Yeah,
the feather.
Yeah.
The feather, how just that's still very deep in our. I mean, most of us, I think, don't live through that, but we know what that feather means, don't we? Yeah. In our culture.
Mm-hmm.
for me it was the black dog. Yeah. This is the black dog depression. I don't know if anybody's ever seen that thing. Yeah. It's tied up with that. Yeah. Yes.
Very interesting. So already what's happening in the process is in the listening, you are beginning to take in some of the character you're hearing. So although you're not physically embodying, it is actually a part of the process that's going on. And if we brought these to life and you were able to interact with the characters, you can see how that also would add into that process. And as the inaction is happening, you're reflexing, actually. You're not just reflecting, you're reflexing, because you're changing the way in which you're thinking based on the things that are coming back to you. So it's an all-encompassing
process. Did you say a bit more about the word reflexing? You said earlier, reflect.
Reflexing,
I'm not sure if I get that, because it seems like a new word.
Yeah, so reflexing, it's interesting, because I don't even know if reflexing exists as a word, but I've kind of created it. Because we get reflecting, we've got reflecting on practice. So people reflect on practice, which means that when they think about something they've done, and they work through that process. That's a really basic exploration. Reflexing is in the moment, right? And in dramatic use, so when you're using it as a drama practitioner, we actually have another term called metaxis. All right, metaxis, if you think of the word praxis, metapraxis is metaxis, okay? It's the idea in a dramatic process of being both character and actor. So I am Eleanor, I know that, and Eleanor is the human being that I am regardless of what I'm doing. But at the moment, I'm also the character of a facilitator of a session. Yeah. So as Eleanor the actor, I am in a process at the moment of going, how am I? What am I feeling, thinking, doing right now? And how does this feel?
Mm-hmm.
And what's the actor in me? You know, what's the facilitator feeling and thinking doing? So reflexing is more than reflecting, in my view.
Yeah.
Reflexing is about understanding who you are in the moment and literally flexing. People talk about it as being a bending back. It's taking
that'll
back
come
that
from
leg.
Some of that still comes from the person of who you are.
Yeah, absolutely.
We do use it in social work a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. So critical reflexivity is actually a very common term in social work within healthcare professions, actually. I take it as not a step further. I just do something in my head around metaxis as being embodied reflexivity. And part of that has come from the fact that I feel when I reflex. Does that make sense?
Yes. Yes.
Whereas when I'm reflecting, sometimes I don't.
You could do it in the head.
Whereas when I'm in the moment, I'm actually feeling this experience. And all of you will be doing the same thing at different levels. The research that I'm doing that's about this anyway has involved practitioners, not of drama, but of a variety of different areas, using this process as a way of embodied reflexivity for their own practice, to look at aha moments, I suppose. Can you do something that's going to change? And that's been amazing, just watching, because you can actually see the click where they go, ting, oh my God. You know, so it's kind of interesting. It is deeper, I think. Does that answer your
question? Yeah, it's got me so interested. I want to speak to you. Right? Honestly,
okay.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm aware of stories.
Yeah.
So next story.
A man stood in Buchanan Street, just at the corner of Nelson Mandela Square. Nobody knows anything about him, but he always has a green bag with him, and he looks like he might not have a home to go to, but he is an amazing flautist. Every day he stands there playing his flute. No one knows anything about him. People pass by and sometimes will drop some money into his hat, but they all love his music.
Draws a lot of strength from being outside all the time and being able to survive outside. He longs for a home and a place of rest.
There's a man, a hairy looking banker man, passed him every day. He never looked at him really or acknowledged him, but he had dropped a pound coin in every day. This man died, and in his will and testament, he left him his stuff.
So, yeah, can I just stop you for 1 second? In that moment where you went, what did you feel?
Hope. hope.
But physically, a physical feeling that went with.
Yeah,
pins and needles.
Yeah, that looks. Yeah, it's interesting.
And with that request from the banker, the unknown person that gave the Splottist hope and a vision of a home of his own.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Okay, next group.
We've got Tracy, young, unmarried single mum, who the pregnancy was unplanned, which reflected on her dreams ruining them or putting a kind of stop to her dream of being a mom with a nice house, nice kitchen, supportive husband and whatnot. But she didn't allow this unplanned pregnancy to put a stop to her dreams and to allow her to dream on about what possible for the future. She feels there was always somebody or something that was going to hinder her and poison her ambitions along the way. She felt like her life was a circus, that she was trying to juggle everything, trying to keep a home and the baby, look for work, keep herself going. But in the end, she did find that structure through her hard work and perseverance to get what that dream was at the end of the day, in secure employment, somebody who loved her, and a happy ever after.
And last
room. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Will you come?
No.
I'm
yes.
You want to talk to that? Okay. There was a positive spirit in the sun, and we knew it was a good positive spirit because there was light all about. However, there was a journey to be undertaken. And that journey had terror and danger and difficulties, perhaps even death, because the red blood showed that, except there might be some positives there. The positives came in the form of someone who could see both sides of the situation and had this strength, could put together opposing views and make a strong kind of support. However, against that, there was the depression and this negative feeling of death and not being and lethargy that would stop progress. However, life is life, and this little being, which is not a real spider, it's more to do with how things are done, grasp the complexity of life, huge web that we spin, and manage to help the spirit become something tangible with a new life starting off in a tree that will take the spirit to the top.
So again, listening to those, you're going to have different reactions as you listen, but could you see if you were using it from that for a therapeutic purpose? If you look at the basic pH, things are coming out from the different stories around the sort of the main focus of how you would cope. So just thinking about that last one, for me, I just kept thinking belief was coming out. There was something around having a belief structure, and that doesn't mean religion, it just means a belief, having something that's focused in that. So as a therapist, you've been looking to this and working with the client on how do you make the most of that, but also can you upscale some of the other things. The research I've done, I've not used basic pH at all. Okay, so the research I've done, I focused purely on the method itself. And then through the process of sharing back that story and doing this objective questioning, subjective questioning, and then bringing to life some of those elements, that's where we've taken the process. I'm going to be really honest, I'm aware of time, so I'm not going to do the image therapy because I don't want to rush it. I'm sorry, but I'm not going to do it. But what I am going to do is I'm going to read you a 6-part story, okay, from my research. And it's my story, and I'm telling you that because what I want you to do is, as you're listening to it, I want you to think not about me, I'm the teller, but it could be anybody. Think about what you're hearing in the story. What questions, what's coming out for you about that story? And we're going to take a couple of minutes to go through part of that process that I would go through with the people I've been working with. This reflexive process in the moment of thinking things through, and you can hear how that works. Okay? So here's the story. It's called The Moment of Truth. If you asked, I doubt that any of the villagers would be able to tell you when the dust began to fall, but they would tell you that it must have been some time ago, years even. It's quite strange because it's almost as though one day people just began to notice. And not necessarily all at once either. They felt an extra heaviness in their step, a shortness of breath, or perhaps they just noticed that they were hunching over more, that they were stooping as they walked, their eyes to the ground. Many of the villagers had, at various points since they noticed the dust, tried to get rid of it. You see, it coated things almost imperceptibly. Floors, carpets, tables, books, lights, clothes, hair, even inside mouths and noses. So they vacuumed and they swept, polished and brushed, but to no avail. The dust simply returned, heavier and more persistent. And recently it was so thick that the villagers began to believe it had some kind of supernatural power. How can it just be dust if every time we clean it away it comes back thicker and stronger? How can it just be dust if it sticks to our clothes and our hair and won't come off, no matter how hard we wash? Some villagers even began to believe that it was the natural course of things. This dust is just protecting us and our belongings from the ravages of time, they would say, as others looked on in fear and mistrust. One of the villagers, Veritas, had felt the dust arrive maybe 3 or 4 years ago. From that point, he had regularly taken out the ladder from his shed and placed it at the side of his house. Climbing each step steadily, he would reach the top and look for the dust, asking himself, where does it begin? Where does it end? At first, these were easy questions. In fact, he rarely needed to climb to the top of the ladder to see the faint line between the clear blue sky and the edge of the dust. But over the years, he had to climb higher and higher, becoming slower and slower as he did so, until today, he couldn't see anything but the dust, thick and black and all-consuming. Veritas believed that he had to do something to try and get rid of the dust, but he also realized that he could not do it alone. He had an idea. And that was to find a new space, free of the dust. He would need ladders, and lots of them, as many as would be needed to climb above the dust and see a way out. Veritas knew that pretty much every villager had a ladder. Over the past few years, the villagers had taken to keeping their ladders locked away in sheds, as had Veritas. Some of the villagers kept the keys to these sheds with them at all times. Others kept their keys hidden away in drawers, underneath papers and string. Some had probably lost their keys altogether. But Veritas knew that there were enough people with keys to unlock their sheds and to pull their ladders together to try and reach above the dust. He called a meeting of the villagers in his house. This was a secret meeting, because many of the villagers were scared of the dust. Remember, they believed it had supernatural powers. Veritas had to be so careful with whom he invited and to where. The invited gathered. One by one they arrived, each with their key. Some openly showing theirs, others remained hidden. They each came in and sat or stood, waiting, hoping, wondering. The meeting was starting to take shape when the knock came. The door shook with anticipation, and Veritas rose to answer it. As he walked towards the door, the letterbox opened, and in began to flow the dust, filling up the floor and the walls and the ceiling. And as it entered, it brought with it an envelope. So, that's the story, and it's... I can answer questions on it because it's my story, so don't worry, I'm fine. Even though it might sound like quite a dark story. But what I want you to do now is just think, what do you want to say about the story, the characters in the story, the task? What are your feelings about it? What are your thoughts? What did you hear? What did you think you heard?
Things were very pervasive. You know, there were things, you know, the dust was covering everything, so no sense of... That's what I felt. And also, I felt powerlessness and frustration with a lot of these emotions that I was feeling, but it just seemed... Things were dark and pervasive, and
yeah,
there
was
still a stroke within it.
You felt quite claustrophobic, yeah. A sense of being squished under, buried under.
There was still hope.
Yeah, interesting. So, yeah,
leader to start seeing where the. I was thinking, I needed a leader to see where the possibilities were. How can he?
harness all those possibilities and take people to a different place.
And there's something there also about, because Veritas as the leader didn't work alone, did he? Mm-hmm. So there's something about connection with others, maybe.
I thought the kind of struggle between saying this isn't what is good for us and thinking almost we can't get rid of it, so we may as well reframe it so that maybe it doesn't, you know, that
yeah.
kind of, do we find something else that we just accept it as?
Okay. So something about changing the thing as opposed to
changing your seeing of it.
Yep, changing your view.
Something about shared experience, but everybody looking at it in a slightly different way.
Do you have any questions?
What's in the envelope?
What's in the envelope?
What's in the
envelope?
Why were the ladders?
Yeah, that's interesting, actually. I think something about I don't know, something about, you know, you kind of don't always you don't always recognise the strengths that you have. Do you know what I mean? So some people, you lock your ladders away just because you don't really need them, and then after a time you lose the key. And, do you know what I mean?
I got a sense that if people are feeling under threat, what they'll do is defend their own. The ladder was seen as a way up out of the clouds to maybe being able to see something and make a change. But it's my ladder because I need this for me and mine. And locking it away is a fear that you lose that route out.
Yeah.
Rather than actually, I got the sense that if the community pulled together as a community, they could probably move out.
Mm-hmm.
But that would take negotiation.
For me, I was interested in the story, but I was going in and out, so I didn't hear the whole thing. That's me. But because there was a feeling of sadness for me. There was a sadness throughout. So I would be interested as a therapist about that.
What's that
in
about?
Me, where's the sadness? Not necessarily the whole story, because I didn't hear it all.
For sure.
But there was sadness.
There was a thread of frustration for me.
Yeah.
Just want to clean the dust and it kept coming back.
You can see if we step out of the story. So if we step out of the story, so the story's been gone, but can you see already through the process that you're going through as a group the impact of that sharing back? So it's my story, but actually now it's yours.
Yeah.
Yeah? Because what you're now doing is you're embodying, you know, it's sitting with you, isn't it? And you think, oh, what is that about? The envelope. What's that about?
Yeah.
How would I think it? You're possibly even picturing yourself sweeping up the dust and getting it away, and you could solve it. Do you see what I mean? And that's that connectivity. So obviously that's quite a strong story. It was a particularly rough professional period of my life that I told that story in, and yet did so very willingly, in the sense that, you know, nobody really knew what was going on, but it enabled me to get a different perspective. Somehow I suddenly wasn't right in the heart of it. I was actually with a group of people who helped me. And then the next bit of that was I asked them, well, would you show me what that looked like? Show me the bits that struck you the most. And they did that. It was a small group anyway, so they showed me different aspects of the story. And physically through this process of image theatre, and then we named what we were seeing, so each thing had a heading, a title. And again, it's that bit about the shared practice. Suddenly it gets even more degree of distance away from me, and I can view it from that field, and it enabled me to see things in different ways, different viewpoints, you know. Anyway, I'm aware of time, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much for your participation and your engagement. I'm happy to answer questions if you want while we're packing up, so feel free. But if you could pass the cards back round.
And can I just say a huge thank you? If there's ever an example of learning by enjoyment and really bringing out lots of quite complex thoughts and issues in an hour, then that was a very good example of it. So thank you very much.